So what I wanted to do tonight a bit is speak about the shadow or the emotional or psychological component of recovery, and also addiction. So I don't want to make it too much of a just a lecture. So I want to try a sort of TED Talk approach where I maybe can just give the information under 20 minutes, and then I just want to give everyone an opportunity just to discuss the issues and also discuss their own personal experience with this area of recovery. So pretty much to start off with, you know, I think the word shadow and all that stuff is used quite loosely these days. And you know, therapy has become such a complex phenomena. Exactly what therapy is and when to do therapy and how to do therapy and when is it appropriate and what type of therapy is appropriate. And I think that's specifically where an integral lens can really be very useful, especially in determining what type of therapy is useful. And we'll touch a bit upon that, a bit later in the talk. But just to start off in the context of addiction. One particular angle that has received quite a lot of attention these days is the relationship between addiction and trauma. And many treatment providers see sort of trauma, the treatment of trauma, as really an essential component of any form of treatment process. And also the 12 steps in many ways as inherent trauma work in it, although it doesn't articulate it in that sense. So maybe just to relate trauma to addiction and how that relates to recovery is that there are many theorists that believe that one of the main sort of etiological, one of the main causes of addiction is preceding trauma, and especially trauma in the early phases of life, between the age of 1 and sort of 4, 1 and 3, one and five. And that's normally the type of trauma when people have suffered any form of trauma in that stage of development can very often lead to addiction in later life. And maybe we can just unpack that a bit. So what these guys say is that pretty much when we're young, we have these relationships with our caregivers, and especially our mother at that stage, that creates these things called survival bonds. And there's also a sort of neurochemical component to that, is when an infant has a connection with his mother that's healthy and rewarding, then a chemical, what they call a reward chemical, is given off that's called beta endorphin, which is actually ironically very similar in structure to morphine. And what happens is when these bonds or these relationships are threatened in whatever way, and it, you know, we're not talking about serious trauma necessarily like abuse or whatever, but just, you know, trauma in any sense that the infant experiences that these bonds are threatened over a consistent period of time, then there's a very profound neurochemical and psychological process that happens within the child. And one of the things that happen also these needs, especially at that age, are often referred to as narcissistic needs. And when these narcissistic needs aren't met, very often people develop, when they become older, they develop a very strong emotional hunger towards these type of narcissistic needs that manifest late in life. And one of the consequences of having these survival bonds or early attachment bonds or relationships threatened in some way at a young age is that the child internalizes, obviously unconsciously, that humans and other people are perceived in some ways to be threatening because they are the objects that you know cause this trauma, cause this distress in these very early stages. And obviously, you know, all of us need to have our needs met in some way. And what the child starts learning, especially if there is later trauma as one grows up, and what the internalized message is that, you know, people are dangerous, I can't have my needs met on people. And from a young age, people that are prone to addiction, or many people that have addiction in later life, you will find a certain pattern that from a young age, they started developing relationships with inanimate objects. And when I refer to inanimate objects, it could be stuff like TV, books, fantasy, especially fantasy that normally plays a pivotal role in this whole thing. But basically the child, the teenager or the young person develops an overly sort of overcompensation with these inanimate objects, which seems to satisfy some of these needs that were unmet. And basically a lot of these theorists would say is that because you sort of develop this capacity to look outside of yourself to have these needs met, and also not just outside yourself, but also outside of yourself in inanimate objects, that becomes a sort of template for one on how to self-regulate when you're an adult. So I actually got a quote here from a guy called Flores that I would just like to read, because it pretty much sums up this whole thing in just one paragraph, if you guys are okay with that. And I think it's a really good quote, so I'm just going to read it slowly. So what Flores says is, addiction is viewed as a misguided attempt at self-repair. Because of unmet developmental needs, certain individuals will be left with an injured, enfeebled, uncohesive, or fragmented self. Such individuals often look good on the outside, but are empty and feel incomplete on the inside. They are unable to regulate affect, and in many cases are even unable to identify what they feel, unable to draw on their own internal resources because there aren't any. They remain in constant need, and in self-psychology they refer to that as object hunger, of having those self-regulating sources met externally, out there. Since painful, rejecting, and shaming relationships are the cause of their deficits in self, they cannot turn to others to get what they need or have never received. Deprivation of needs and object hunger leaves them with unrealistic and intolerable effects that are not only disturbing to others but shameful to themselves. Consequently, alcohol, drugs, and other external sources of gratification, food, work, sex, etc., take on a regulating function while creating a false sense of autonomy, independence, and denial for others. And then he closes by saying, addiction is an attempt at self-help that fails. So just one or two things that I'd like to expand upon, which I think is really pivotal, is there's these two elements. The one element is that very often people that are prone to addiction firstly look on the outside to have their emotional needs met, and they relate to these narcissistic needs as kids very often. But the other thing that's very important, and one can look how that relates to the 12 steps, for instance, is the sense that, as he puts it, creates a false sense of autonomy, independence, and denial of the need of others. And that's very often a central drive in people that suffer from addiction. And one can, from this point of view, one can understand why. You know, if people were the ones that let you down, you want to find a way of having your needs met that aren't dependent on other people. So when adults with these type of issues very often find drugs, or any form of addictive behavior, the feeling that the drug gives one, you know, if you have these issues and you start drinking, when you drink, the experience, the phenomenological experience of being drunk or tipsy or whatever, gives a sense that my needs are met and I didn't have to depend on another person for that. You know, I can go to the bar, I can phone the dealer, or I can work, or I can whatever. I can get my needs met through a way that I'm in control. And really control is the central issue here, this sort of false sense of control, really, but a very strong desire for control, because one of the main things that kids would feel, or anybody feels when they when they experience trauma, is that one's out of control. And especially if it happens when you're young, you sort of internalize the sense of that, you know, life is out of control, I'm out of control, and one develops a very disproportionate need for control. And it's no coincidence that the first step of NA or AA, for instance, is all about control. You know, people very often misinterpret the step, that it's sort of, you know, I'm powerless, I can't do anything, you know, that is what you need to admit. But that's not really what the step refers to. It refers to more giving up this false sense of control that you think you have over a specific behavior or substance. It's not that you don't have any control in your life. And giving up that control is a very, very essential component of any recovery process, because control, relying on an external object and the idea that that gives you control, really is psychologically one of the essential sort of psychodynamic or dynamic forces that perpetuate or sort of start off recovery. And obviously what happens, as we all know in this call, is the more that you try and control, the less control you have as you become addicted, and the more need you have for control. And that just carries, you know, that just spirals deeper and deeper. And consequently, you feel more out of control, then you try and get back control, and that, by getting back control, you're even more out of control. And, you know, that's just the process that goes on and on. And normally when people enter any form of treatment process, they do so because they have some realization that their attempt at controlling, whether it's other people, like through codependency or it's gambling or drugs or whatever, is they come to some realization that actually they're not in control of this thing. But for people like that, or not for people like that, for people like us, really, the illusion of control is a very enticing thing for people that have these control issues. And it always reminds you of that story of in Walt Disney, which I think was actually the first Walt Disney cartoon ever made. It was called Phantasmagoria or something like that in those days, but it's the one where Mickey Mouse is with his wizard. He's like an apprentice, and he's with his wizard, and when the wizard goes out, he's too lazy to, you know, to do his duties, and then he uses a spell to get a broom to, you know, mop up the floor or sweep the floor, and eventually it gets out of control, and then he chops up the broom with an axe or something, and then there's like 50 brooms that start sweeping and gets out of control, and eventually chops up more, and eventually the whole thing just, you know, becomes completely chaotic. And that story is actually a very good analogy for addiction, where one, you know, tries sort of through this magical elixir, whether it's drugs or whatever, to try and gain control over something that one shouldn't have control. And an essential component of that is really our feelings, because that's the our inner world. That is the part that feels out of control. And that is the part that we try and control through drugs and alcohol. And as we can see, that all relates back to that early wounding from this perspective, and why control is so essential for people with that issue. So I'm going to leave it there just on this topic, because obviously one could speak about this forever. But I think that pretty much covers the basic points of view as far as this is concerned. Any feedback on that before we move on to something else?
It's Lisa. I just had just a couple things. How would you define trauma?
Yeah, well, that's a that's a difficult question, because I think it's, like I said, it's one of those words that are used so widely that it's lost sort of meaning in a way. But I think the way that I'd like to, the way that I would like to understand trauma from personally is, it's something that happens that seriously disrupts some need. And very often, you know, people just see trauma as something somebody does to one, you know, like abuse or, you know, whatever, you know, normally people, so it as abuse, somebody did that to you, therefore you traumatized or you went to war or whatever. But I mean, what is essential there is that clearly you had some need for care that was disrupted. And that's a very clear trauma. But there's many other forms of trauma where whatever need you had, especially as a young kid, because as a child, virtually all your needs, especially before the age of five, every single need you have is, you know, virtually entirely dependent on your caregivers or the people close to you. You know, like there's very few of your needs that you can supply yourself. So especially at that age, if any of these needs are seriously compromised, then that will be experienced as trauma. So it can also be the other end of the scale where let's say a young kid is very inquisitive, but his family doesn't allow the child to be inquisitive and sort of belittles him for being inquisitive or clever or whatever. You know, so it can even be mild stuff like that.
Yeah,
but I think the essential definition I would have is some profound disruption of a need, pretty much. I think that could probably describe it the most clearest. Does that make sense?
Totally answers what I was asking. And the only other comment I had is I am finding it really helpful in the context of what you're saying to. And I just noticed it based on you're talking about how addiction's like sort of a way we try to control our emotions is spending a lot of time just experiencing my emotions. And that has just been amazing because I found there was a real addiction to thinking, one, I should always feel good, and two, not even exploring the terrain of my emotions. And just been so helpful experiencing them without getting too wrapped up in them. You know, in a way that I experience them physically, I, you know, ask myself questions about them. I, you know, get involved with them to a point without becoming identified with them. And that's just, you're just shoring up to me how important that is for me.
Yeah. And the problem with that is that if there was any trauma in one's life to that extent, one of the consequences of trauma is that it affects the system in our mind that regulates emotions. So three of the things that people struggle with, which are very common with addicts, that's why a lot of early treatment is about emotional literacy. So three of the things that people struggle with that experience trauma is the one is they cannot either they can't actually feel the experience. So let's say there's pain or shame. They can't actually feel it. There is no experience of the feeling. That's one possibility. The other possibility is that there is an experience. So phenomenologically, they'll feel, listen, here, there's something seriously wrong, but they're not capable of not even necessarily articulating and naming it, but not capable of really understanding that, well, this is pain. Even if they don't give it a fancy name, they just can't feel that specific thing. So the feeling, the feeling world becomes very murky, very mercurial. It's sort of this vague sense of there's something wrong. And part of addiction treatment is firstly feeling the feeling, secondly being aware that there's a specific feeling, and then being able to give that specific feeling a name. And then on top of that, knowing that each feeling, you know, I see feelings in a way as sort of a cop, you know, feelings as a purpose to alert us to certain needs. And every time, you know, if your oil light goes on, then you know, listen, I need to put in oil. But if your oil light isn't working, you're never going to know when to put in oil. So feelings alerts us to certain needs. And that's one of the things that perpetuates the initial traumas that firstly, your dashboard doesn't work, so you don't know when to put in oil, you don't know when to put in gas. And also the other thing people like that do, and addicts very often do, is they'll confuse the gas with the oil. So you think you're sad, or you think you're happy, but you're actually sad, or you think you're depressed, but you're actually angry. So one confuses the feeling, and because each feeling has a very specific need, you know, you'll put in oil in your gas tank. And in many ways, that's what addiction is. You feel this feeling, although you don't know what it is, and you try and medicate the feeling, or you try and regulate the feeling by putting the wrong substance into the wrong container. You know, I'm just using a silly analogy of a car, you know. And the problem is the need behind the feeling never gets satisfied. You know, so if you're really lonely and you feel like some connection, you know, you can go jogging, you can read a book, you can make $1 million, you can take a lot of drugs. All of those things might be fine on their own, but it's not actually satisfying the feeling of wanting to connect with something. So recovery is very much about knowing what feeling you're feeling, and also knowing what type of action or what type of behavior will actually satisfy the need behind the feeling. And then, you know, if you're angry and you need to express your anger, once you express the anger, the feeling light goes off. There is an anger or sadness or whatever the need is.
Yeah, so it sounds like dialoguing with that emotion and is important in identifying its needs.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, it all boils down to needs very often. Needs are such a useful construct to use in these things. Because addiction is just a misguided way of having needs met, and recovery in many ways can simply be understood. Obviously, I'm oversimplifying grossly here, but in many ways it can just simply be understood as finding healthy ways to satisfy one's needs. And when these needs are satisfied, like if you're thirsty and you drink water, then there's no reason to then go and drink dirty water, you know, which is sort of what addiction is. You know, if you have a need for something, then addiction satisfies that need. But when you actually have that need met in a way that authentically satisfies it, that need is satisfied. You know, the gestalt is closed, and you won't necessarily then crave a dysfunctional way to have that need met.
Makes sense.
And in a way, that's the way one can see relapse prevention or sustainable recovery is really developing a lifestyle where one's needs are met on a consistent basis. And people that manage to do that experience much less cravings, much less desire to really turn to this old, outdated way of having needs met. And the opposite is also true. People that get into recovery, and they can do all sorts of good stuff, but if their basic needs still aren't met, then, you know, psychologically their mind is aware that, listen, I can get this need met somehow. It's a bad way, but I can still have this need met. And that is often translated into cravings, sort of just a vague craving that can very often lead to relapse.
So just real quickly, in summary, would you say it's safe to say, like, there's some stuff that I myself am comfortable identifying and exploring and dialoguing with, and it's not what I would call in the shadow. It's not massively disowned in a trauma. And then it sounds like if there was some feelings that I was numb to or unable to navigate or completely unaware of, but still there was this sense, you know, or there was a relapse continuing or that kind of thing, like that might be something that it would be good to navigate with somebody who knows what they're doing.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that's where the idea of the shadow comes in, is that for some reason, somewhere along the line, whatever happened, the individual unconsciously decided to repress this feeling or this thought, whatever it is, because it was too painful to deal with. I mean, having a shadow is a very useful defense mechanism. And if we didn't have shadows, we'd probably go insane, you know, especially when you're young. So
at least, or at least kill each other. One of the two.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, I suppose that's what war is, and violent crime is just when people repress the shadow, or these shadows come out and they don't know what to do with it. So shadow's got a very, very useful psychological function at the time, but when it goes too far, then it really represses aspects of ourselves that is very necessary for sort of psychic integration and
did we lose you?
Especially, can you still hear me?
Oh, okay. I
you were breaking up quite a bit.
You were breaking up there for a minute.
Oh, is it? Okay. So just on the issue of shadow, it's directly linked with trauma, because the shadow really is the traumatic episodes or traumatic inner thoughts or wherever it comes from, is something that was repressed because it was too painful to be held in awareness. And the fact that it is a shadow by definition means it's something that you're not aware of. So therapy in conjunction with emotional literacy is really the process where you become aware of the pain, you become aware of something, and then the emotional literacy part is where you learn how to actually articulate it and deal with it. And if that doesn't happen consistently or enough, then the person remains psychologically prone to relapse, because, like I said, their main way of dealing with a shadow or dealing with the trauma was their primary way of using, or many levels of using. Any feedback on that?
Now, this is Victoria, and my habitual way of dealing with trauma from childhood was to dissociate. And then I spent a lot of years trying to figure out with my head, sometimes through therapy, sometimes on my own, what that was all about. It's been fairly recently that I have learned to just stay with an experience as it arises, initially without trying to name it or understand it, but just being with it. And that has probably been the most successful thing I've done, because eventually it does become clear. It's almost like an intuitive sense that comes up and then knows what it is and where it comes from.
Yeah, I would agree with that. I think conventional talk therapy, one of the problems with talk therapy, in the sense of the sort of conventional psychoanalytic mode of therapy where you talk about these things, is that especially shadow material that was repressed before the age of sort of 2.5, 3 can't actually be consciously recollected, because your brain wasn't developed yet to really remember the stuff at that stage. So it's really outside of memory. So no amount of shadow work as such will really loosen that stuff. So I think what you're speaking about also refers to that type of trauma, and more sort of body work where it's not really about understanding it or articulating it or seeing where it comes from, but it's sort of more somatic, a more cellular way of releasing the stuff.
Right.
It's fabulous. It sounds like what I'm hearing is like, it's, and I've heard Robert Augustus Masters talk about this too, is how important it is to work these things psychologically, but also in the non-dualistic sense, which is kind of what I'm hearing Victoria say, something a little more transcendent, like coming from both places when I can, it just sounds so valuable. It's like dealing with the absolute and the relative. If sure. that makes any sense.
Yeah. And also dealing with from a sort of non-dual and also from a pre-personal. So there's really three angles looking
oh,
at,
yeah,
you know,
right.
wellness level is you can deal it from a pre-personal stage, you can deal from the sort of personal stages or the transpersonal. The thing is with specifically addiction is what I've certainly found in my experience and what a lot of researchers seem to echo is that the you know, pretty much one of the central things that you'll see in many addicts is some form of developmental issues at a very, very young age. It's a very common thing. I mean, I've very seldom encountered, I mean, obviously you get the exception, but I think the biggest part of the addict population will have some issues at that age. And that's what makes it so difficult to treat as well, is that conventional psychotherapy is pretty useless for treating that stuff, especially in the first 2 years. That's why I tell people in the first 2 years, they shouldn't do any form of conventional psychotherapy. They can do counseling, you know, supportive therapy, but any serious shadow work, as far as I'm concerned, should be really avoided in the first couple of years. So maybe we can talk a little bit about taking an integral perspective on actually the therapeutic process itself, because we sort of just touched upon it by mentioning that well trauma can happen at various stages of development, and also different therapies also work at different stages of development. And so one of the very useful things that especially the integral psychology guys have done is sort of develop a developmental or taxonomy of what therapies are useful at what stages. And for those of you that have read Wilbur's integral psychology, that's where he sort of started that whole approach. And I find that particularly useful, especially when working with addiction and working with recovering addicts at different stages of development. And what Wilbur simply has pointed out is that, you know, each form of therapy, when we look at the different developmental stages of any human being, from the very pre-personal, the higher stages, and then the sort of transpersonal level, is that each therapy, in many ways, is designed to work at a certain level of development, not necessarily to work at a certain level of development, but to treat a trauma or to treat an issue at a certain level of development that happened at that stage. Because normally when the stage of development where the trauma happened is where the shadow sort of gets cut off. You know, the shadow will remain at that particular level. It will stay there. So if you had some trauma at the age of 2, the shadow that will split off due to that trauma or the traumatic material remains at the age of 2. You know, the trauma doesn't develop with you. The trauma, one of the problems of the trauma is that it gets stuck there. So it's like cutting off a piece of cheese and it just sort of gets stuck there. So what they have pointed out is that specific therapies will deal specifically with a sort of strata or layer of trauma at a certain age of development, and other therapies will become not necessarily useless, but will become less effective at that specific stage. And if we look at what we understand as psychotherapy, which is the typical, you see a therapist and then, you know, you sit down and you talk about your problems and you discuss it and we analyze it and we think back of where, you know, I got caused, it was related to the family of origin, etc. That is a very specific mode of therapy, and that is a type of therapy that only works at specific layers of emotional development. And then there's all sorts of other therapies like stuff like DBT, which, for instance, work for more earlier levels of trauma, which is particularly useful for addicts because DBT addresses the sort of narcissistic stages where if there was trauma at that stages, it provides assistance to an individual with that type of trauma. And what one also needs to understand is that different therapies do different things, and using the wrong therapy for the wrong trauma can actually become deleterious, can actually have the opposite effect. For instance, if somebody had trauma at the narcissistic stages of development, one of the problems they'll have is a sort of a weak sense of self or cohesive sense of self, sometimes referred to as borderline personality or narcissistic personality, but there's a structural deficit in the person due to that it wasn't that well developed at that age. So what you don't want to do to somebody with a structural deficit in the sense of self is to further weaken the sense of self. And there's two things that can do that, that can weaken the sense of self. One is meditation, for instance, especially sort of open meditation where there isn't any concentrating going on. And the other one is sort of conventional psychotherapy where you bring up more shadow material and you release more trauma through the therapy. And so if one looks at addicts, which is the context of what we're speaking in, is that very, very often addicts have that trauma at these earlier stages of development. So the beginning stages of recovery and the beginning stages of any therapeutic endeavor with a recovering addict in early stages of recovery shouldn't be to now further loosen this sort of frail by, you know, archaeologically digging up more trauma material because he's struggling just to keep everything together. What you need to do is you first need to build up the sense of self so that the guy can actually repress the stuff. And once it's repressed, then you want to help him repress it. And going the other way around can actually have quite a hectic effect on people. I've seen that very often where somebody with a year clean or 6 months clean goes into some form of deep psychoanalysis or deep therapy, and they just freak out. They just can't sit with the material that gets released. So stuff like DBT, dialectic behavior therapy, is very good at that stage just because it doesn't release any trauma material or shadow material. It merely builds psychic strength or ego strength. And then when a person is more stable in later recovery or later stages of development, then one can bring in a more uncovering therapy like psychoanalysis or Jungian therapy or Gestalt, whatever, that uncovers more repressed material. And then when one gets to a later stage where it's not so much about repressing material, where it's maybe more about cognitive distortions, or especially relationship issues, misinterpreting stuff, and stuff like cognitive behavioral therapy comes in useful, and the more existentially orientated therapies become useful. But existential psychotherapy will be pretty useless for somebody with serious narcissistic disorders, especially about resolving that issue. I mean, they might have some meaning of life issues, but it won't really touch sides on the earlier stages of development. So just having a developmental map of therapies relative to developmental stages is a very useful schema to have. And then also for the transpersonal levels and the higher levels, you know, psychoanalysis isn't going to do any, is going to virtually not touch side if you're struggling with self-actualization issues or serious meaning of life issues or spiritual issues. It just wasn't designed to go to that level. And then at the same time, spiritually orientated therapies like maybe even yoga or meditation or non-dual stuff is also not designed to resolve very early trauma stuff. And I see that a lot in the recovery world,
yeah,
where people, you know, immediately go for the meditation and non-dual and, you know, let's get over the ego and all these type of things. And that can have very, won't say severe, but it can have significant consequences, because you know, your problem isn't that you need to get over your ego. Your problem is that your ego was never formed healthy enough to start off with. And that is your problem. So once your ego and all that stuff is stable and is healthy and can function in the world, then at later stages, you know, through more non-dual or more transpersonal practices, one then starts focusing on transcending the ego, but also maintaining a healthy ego. But if you're busy transcending your ego and you have a very weak ego structure to start off with, that can only lead to significant problems in later on. So let me stop there and then hear what you guys have to say.
So, Guy, Victoria again, one of my questions is about the binaural iAwake technologies, and those are meditation, but my understanding is those are used from the very beginning in early recovery. So how does that fit into all of this?
Well, I would say I'm not an expert on the neuroscience of binaural feedback, but I think my take on that would be is that for a lot of people, binaural and or brainwave entrainment stuff helps them to release shadow material. But I think the benefit of something like that is that just because you're listening to a binaural track, it isn't necessarily going to mean, you know, you are now releasing shadow material. I think what it does is it assists people that are ready to release shadow material. I don't think it will just force anybody into a sort of random process of just releasing shadow stuff. Where therapies like psychoanalysis, you know, the main aim of the therapy is really to go down there and to release this stuff. So I think binaural brain entrainment works in a way that if you're ready for it to be released, it will come up. If you're not ready, I think you can listen to brain entrainment maybe even for years before any material is necessarily released. So I think it's got a more, I'm not even sure what the word would be, but a more idiosyncratic way of helping people release stuff. When people are ready, it will come up. When they're not ready, it will, you know, I don't think it will necessarily affect them in that way.
Hi, everybody. This is Hamlet. I've been here. I'm not feeling well enough with you guys today. Hi.
Hi, Hamlet.
Hi. Guy, what you just said resonated with me. I'm just concerned because, you know, when I've heard John speak about sitting with brainwave entrainment and having these feelings come up and this pain or trauma. And, you know, I've never experienced any of that in meditation.
Yeah.
And I don't know if it's because maybe I'm not ready to look at it. I'm one of those that got into meditation very early in recovery. I wasn't even in recovery. I mean, all I was in treatment and I had a bunch of free time and all I did was just start to sit quietly with myself. And I don't know if maybe that caused more harm than good. I mean, I'm clean today, and I'm starting to become aware of levels in me and stuff that I wasn't aware of before. You know.
Yeah. No, absolutely. Well, let me just qualify this. There's two major forms, in my understanding, major forms of meditation. The one is where your attention is focused on the sort of openness. You're not focusing your awareness on anything, like the more advanced stages of Zen meditation. But a lot of the meditations are focused meditations that is a concentrating meditation. For instance, mindfulness, we're always focusing on the breath, or transcendental meditation, we're focusing on a mantra, etc. And those forms of meditations are quite useful for people at really any stage, because it helps build psychic structure. The meditations that are can become dangerous for people is the more open meditations where there's no concentrating part going on. And those meditations are normally designed to sort of, once they dissolve the ego, but to transcend the ego, where focused meditations are useful at actually strengthening the ego. So that's an important distinction to make as well. That's why a lot of mindfulness meditation is used for people in early recovery, but some of the other meditations won't be useful for them. And also, just as far as entrainment goes, you know, I've used entrainment very often myself, and I've also never experienced any serious shadow upheaval. And I know many people that haven't, but there are also other people that really have. So I think that's why I say is that, you know, if you're not ready, or you've done a lot of therapy yourself and you've gone through a lot of stuff and have dealt with a lot of things, then, you know, you're not going to release something that isn't there. But for somebody that the time is right and the stuff is just below the surface, I think something like brainwave entrainment can release a lot of repressed stuff. But I don't think it will happen when the person's sort of repressive skills or their psychological defense mechanisms are still in place.
And from what I understand, too, it's Lisa, with the brainwave entrainments, especially in early recovery, that's so valuable is, and again, I'm paraphrasing, I'm not speaking as an expert, that's for sure, but my understanding is that a lot of times early in recovery and soon after, you know, we're coming out of a locus of control in that lizard brain and in the mammalian brain, and it helps move us, you know, get the neocortex back online, get us more into our parasympathetic nervous system, help us solve problems and think properly. So from what I'm understanding, it's really great for the neurochemistry of the brain to do the kind of focusing meditations that you're talking about. I can see where transcendental type meditations or, you know, having a non-dualistic experience would probably have a completely different neurochemical response in the brain and wouldn't be real helpful. But it sounds to me like, I know for me it was really true just what Hamlet was saying. It was really helpful for me because I was operating in a fight-or-flight mentality when I got clean. And what it helped me to do was have that more informed by the thinking, newer neocortex of my brain, and it seemed to really help that.
Yeah, no, absolutely. You know, so there's many ways that brainwave entrainment can operate in. You know, on some ways are just operating on a way that it releases more serotonin or endorphins and stuff like that, and rewires some of the brain, and then there's some psychological function as well. And I think for various people it will manifest in a different way. But for most people, it will certainly have a calming effect. It will help people get into certain brainwave states that is very useful for them because, you know, another way of understanding addiction as well that's very useful is understanding it as a desire to achieve certain altered states. And the more you achieve a certain altered states by drugs, the less capacity you have to achieve that altered state naturally by yourself. And that has also got a serious neurochemical component. So if you use urine for a long time, your capacity to yourself go into a relaxed sort of theta state or alpha state is going to be seriously compromised. So I think particularly, especially for people that used a lot of downers, the brainwave entrainment tracks that work on theta and alpha can be very useful. They found that alcoholics in general have a serious problem in generating low alpha in their brain. And that is exactly the level what alcohol does. When you drink alcohol, it creates alpha levels, alpha states. So there's obviously a direct link between neurophysiology, brain states, addiction and brain states. And I think one of the unexplored areas of binaural and brainwave entrainment is really looking at how one can make more specific ways of helping specific type of addicts to you know, achieve these states, which drugs normally used to give them and help them to naturally, organically, manufacture or go into these states themselves without drugs or alcohol.
Wow, so specific hertz levels for specific kinds of addiction.
Yeah, absolutely.
Wow.
So for instance, what I would, you know, normally the brainwave entrainment stuff is, I think it's more useful for people that take downers, but for the people that are actually addicted to uppers, I think sometimes they wouldn't need the alpha theta brainwave entrainment. What they would actually need is more brainwave entrainment tracks that are stimulating, because a lot of people that are addicted to uppers are also the ADD population of the addict population. And what would give them a kick, or what would be really useful for them, is actually listening to more beta, higher beta or lower beta tracks that will help their brain to actually stimulate themselves. Because one of the problems of long-term use of stimulants is that your brain finds it difficult to actually inhabit, you know, healthy stimulating states of consciousness. So it's not just the thing of let's all go down to theta the whole time. For different people, different different tracks will be more applicable and more useful.
And you said downers, alpha and theta with a T, right?
Excuse me?
When you're talking about what was you thought was best for people who did downers, you said alpha and theta, right? Theta with a TH. Okay.
Yeah.
Guy, would you be willing to go into this a little bit more? I would like to maybe take some notes and see how profound. I have the profound meditation audio, but the track listing doesn't show which waves are functioning on each track, which waves are, you know, which tracks are targeted for each wave. Maybe we can get more into this on like on a lecture on a Friday, take some notes and see like stuff that can apply personally to each one of us. At least I would like that for me.
Definitely. So I think there's some of that stuff in the manual, the PMP manual, printed manual.
Yeah.
How did you get that? I didn't get a printed manual, though.
I could send you the link, or Guy could send you the link, probably.
Sure.
Yeah. I know that as far as I understand, most of the tracks have got a manual, and then actually in the manual, you know, I was looking at the Deepest Euphoria the other day, it actually gives quite a clear indication of, you know, the first 8 minutes, it's alpha, then it's like high theta and stuff like that. So I think what's quite useful for people is to sort of experiment which track works better for someone. Because one must also understand that some people have too much of certain brainwaves. And then listening too much of that track might not necessarily be beneficial for one. So one needs to experiment a bit and see which one works. And especially if it's something like you, Hamlet, that seem to like your uppers in your day, actually doing some beta stimulation at certain times of the day might do you good.
Okay.
That's the tracks they used to use in the olden days for all that study kits. Would be like sort of low beta, and it just gets you sharp and focused like a cup of coffee would.
Okay.
I think we're coming to an end here. Any final comments?
Just a quick question. Can we get a list? Is there somewhere in one of the books or in a book that we can get? I guess it would be in the integral psychology books of the developmental stages you were talking about, what therapies are appropriate for what levels of trauma?
Yeah. In Wilbur's book, Integral Psychology, there's a good chart.
Okay.
And then also, if you're more interested in that, I'd recommend Mark Forman's book, Integral Psychotherapy, as well, that also really deals pretty much in depth with that specific concept, and our different therapies relate to different stages.
Cool.
And I know that a guy called Andre Marquise and Elliot Ingersoll has just released a new book, I think called The Integral, I can't remember what it's called. And they've also done quite a lot of work on developing these sort of quite comprehensive charts that indicate what therapies work at what level of, developmental level of trauma, etc.
What was it called, the last one?
It's Andre Marquise and Elliot Ingersoll. I can't recall the name of the book.
Okay, Elliot Ingersoll. Okay, yeah. Got it. Thanks.
Yeah, so there's any stuff that we haven't covered. I mean, obviously, we've just touched the tip of the iceberg of, you know, the psychological dimension of addiction. One can carry on forever on this topic. But maybe on Friday, we can just have a bit of a more broader discussion just on some of the topics. And we can even talk about some of the stuff that you were mentioning, the Amulet, and just explore it a bit further.
Sure.
That'd be great.
Mm-hmm.
Cool. Guys, as usual, it's a pleasure speaking with such a receptive audience. and they're looking forward to our talk on Friday.
Okay. Thanks a lot for your time, Guy.
Thanks, Guy. This has been great.
Okay. Right. Thanks, guys. We'll chat soon.
Talk to you soon, everyone.
Bye. Okay. Take care.
Bye. Bye, everybody.
Bye.
Bye.